From Michigan Radio, this is a State of Opportunity special. I'm Cynthia Candy. Today, we will look back over 5 years of State of Opportunity reporting.
The vision we had going in was like, you know, we're not going to press conferences. We're not going to be talking only to legislators in Lansing.
Looking at low-income kids and families, this is the most undeveloped talent pool in the state of Michigan.
If you see the silver lining or you think outside of the box, that you can see the beautiful thing in every situation.
It's really difficult to figure out all of the pieces of the puzzle that low-income families are trying to put together to keep their families safe and comfortable.
He changed our lives by just that little bit to get us where we needed to go, and we are so appreciative.
Our final State of Opportunity special, those stories and much more for you today. But first, the news. Hello, I'm Cynthia Canty, and welcome to our special look at State of Opportunity. This project began in 2012. Since then, the State of Opportunity team has brought us hundreds of stories exploring the barriers to success that low-income kids and families in Michigan face every day. As this project wraps up, we're going to spend this hour looking at three major areas for State of Opportunity stories: infant mortality, early childhood education, and what happens when young people age out of foster care. Dustin Dwyer is our State of Opportunity reporter who has covered Grand Rapids and the west side of Michigan. And Jennifer Guerra is based on the east side of the state. Welcome.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to talk.
Take us back 5 years to when State of Opportunity launched. Dustin, what was the vision?
Well, when I first got involved in State of Opportunity, it was really just an idea. I had actually taken some time off from Michigan Radio, and I was being a stay-at-home dad. And this idea came, I think, from folks at the Kellogg Foundation. Our station manager at the time, Tamar Charney, reached out and said, well, if we have this possibility for a project to focus on kids, and specifically kids from low-income families, what might it look like? What might we want to do? So I started looking into that and came up with this idea that we proposed to have a project where we would do a story every week that was sounded a lot like the normal public radio stories you might hear, that it keeps up with some news events. It's about, you know, usually about 4 minutes long, and we'd have those sort of weekly stories. But we'd also have a chance to have these longer stories, these long narratives where we'd get to know people, sort of understand them, their community, their environment. And so the idea was to really bring those two ideas together to see what we could learn as journalists by having that approach.
And Jen, what was your mission statement, if you will?
Well, I think Dustin summed it up perfectly. I think the vision we had going in was like, you know, we're not going to press conferences. We're not going to be talking only to legislators in Lansing. It was all about being in the homes, being with the families, being in the classroom, and really seeing how life unfolds for people.
So let's talk about what has evolved and what might be different for low-income children and families today from when the project began, in terms of first with infant mortality.
Good news to report there is the infant mortality rate in Michigan has gone down, which is excellent. I mean, it's still higher than it should be, but it is going down. So that is a good thing that has happened over the last 5 years.
And Dustin, what about access to state and federal programs that help poor and at-risk children? How have we done over the 5 years?
Well, first of all, the state of Michigan, one thing that's different now today than when we started is access to preschool, specifically for four-year-olds. The state has put a lot more money into making preschool available for four-year-olds. Right now, that money is targeted at four-year-olds from low-income families. I think there's talk of even expanding that. That's where I see the biggest change, I would say. You know, some things have changed, but they're not a measurable improvement or certain things. I mean, when it comes to K-12 schools, when we started the project, we had the MEEP, and I did a whole documentary about kids getting ready to take the MEEP, their standardized test. Now the state standardized test for K-12 schools is totally different, but I think it's a little too soon to say for sure what's changed because of that or whether it's better. A lot has certainly changed in the 5 years, that we can say that.
And Jim, what about the prospects for young people as they age out of foster care?
Well, foster care, I would say sort of as we were reporting, like starting around 2012-ish when we started, foster care system for aging out was improving. So Michigan is actually one of the leading states in terms of helping kids age out. They can stay in the system longer, which is good. And now it's not quite a full ride for kids from aging out of foster care, but their tuition is pretty much the whole thing is covered if they decide to go to college. So that is one of the better things about living in Michigan and being in the foster care system. They do have some coverage here.
I guess just if we want to talk overall, what needs to change in what the state's doing to improve life and outcomes for low-income families and children?
The thing that I noticed over and over was just the lack of resources in schools for kids living in poverty. The effects of poverty are they're huge. And we do expect to put that on the backs of teachers. And I don't think that's fair. And it doesn't seem to be working. So we need schools to have more resources, more counselors, more social workers, more nurses, more, you know, everything to help deal with the effects of poverty. And that will improve their educational outcomes. So that's something I think needs improvement.
What do you think, Dustin?
You know, just to jump off of what Jen said, I think she and I both had different experiences looking at schools because we both went into a lot of school districts, but a lot of my time was spent in Grand Rapids Public Schools and a lot of Jen's time was spent in Detroit Public Schools. And the problems facing both of those districts are very different. I would say in the schools that I spent a lot of time in, particularly Congress Elementary, resources weren't the problem. There were plenty of resources. There were lots of people around, volunteers who helped with tutoring. There was, the community does shoe drives and gets coats for kids and supplies for kids at the beginning of the year. There were plenty of resources. The big takeaway, I think, overall for me from the project was not a question of what resources do kids need, but just like understanding that the positive, real great qualities that a lot of these kids have. I think it's one of the problems in Grand Rapids and maybe in some districts that people see kids from an urban background or from a low-income background, and they do want to donate or they want to, you know, chip in to give them things rather than just looking at the kids and saying, wow, this is a talented person. I've come to believe that, you know, when looking at low-income kids and families, this is the most undeveloped talent pool in the state of Michigan. Just imagine if we actually saw these kids and saw their talents and really gave them opportunities, just really connections and just to see what they can do and give them the opportunity to prove it in a different setting. It's not a policy issue, but I think it's something that could make a big change.
Dustin Dwyer, Jennifer Guerra, our State of Opportunity team. We want to congratulate you both on 5 years of hard work and reporting on State of Opportunity. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Too many Michigan babies are dying. For every 1,000 babies born in our state, roughly 7 won't make it to their first birthday. That's a full point higher than the national infant mortality rate. And when you break that down by race, the numbers are even more disturbing. African American babies are twice as likely to die before they turn 1 than white babies. And in some Michigan cities, that disparity is much higher. In 2012, Jennifer Guerra spoke with Shantania Smith. Her infant son, JJ, died after only a few weeks.
It's hard. It's really hard to deal with. Because it's like I have so many people. I have a huge support system. But sometimes I really feel like I have nobody because I don't like to bring the pain back up in them. I don't like to see them cry as well. And I know if I bring it up, they're going to. So it's extremely hard. And it's been over 2 years and has not got better at all.
With us now is Amy Zagman, who's executive director of the Michigan Council for Maternal and Child Health. Amy, when the State of Opportunity Project launched in 2012, Michigan's infant mortality rate was 6.9 per 1,000 births. Where are we today?
I think we're just slightly better than that, around 6.8. And the rate's not going to go down dramatically quickly. If you understand infant mortality and dig into it a little bit, you realize that there is only so much you can do with what's called excess infant mortality beyond those deaths that can be anticipated because of birth defects, et cetera. So that's the infant mortality that we focus on.
So, yeah, what are the most important things being done right now?
So there's a lot of work being done in communities and a lot of work being done at the state level to make sure that communities have the supports and resources they need. So it's really important for folks to understand that infant mortality is a indicator that indicates the health of a community. It also indicates sort of the resources that are available for families to be healthy and for women to be healthy and have healthy birth outcomes. So it isn't one thing. Infant mortality isn't one thing. There's not one thing we can do to fix it. And what we've really tried to do in the last couple of years, and this isn't just the organization I work for, but a collective effort, is really make sure that all of the efforts that are going on locally are driven by real data, because it's also important to know that infant mortality varies across the state as far as what the actual drivers are. You talked a little bit about disparities and how that differs by community, but it's also can really vary as far as root cause.
When we talk about those root causes, I know one of the things that we've picked up over the years is this real big emphasis on education, on safe sleep practices. How important is that?
That's huge when we talk about excess infant mortality, because beyond babies who are born low birth weight or premature, who we want to prevent those things from happening, and we obviously have health interventions, there are infants who are otherwise healthy who then we lose, and those are really the most preventable. You pointed out education. I think it's education for everyone involved. So a lot of our efforts right now are focused on the mother and the family. I really think what we need to do is broaden that circle and make sure that everyone in the community is supporting families to make the best sleep choice possible. Not only, you know, childcare and grandparents, but everyone really needs to embrace the idea of being supportive of on your back, alone, in a crib, in the parent's room, but not in their bed. And those are really the safe sleep tenets. And if we stick with those, we know that the rate dramatically decreases.
And all signs are pointing to federal funding for health initiatives potentially being reduced. What do you think that could mean to the infant mortality battle in Michigan and really our country?
Well, I think one of the most troubling things about the federal cuts is understanding that they will have an impact on services that are provided that are state-based as well. So in addition to the ability of parents to be able to purchase affordable insurance, it will have impact on our state Medicaid program. And over 50% of the births in the state are Medicaid-funded. And to the extent that cuts are made around services and supports to women on Medicaid or even outside the Medicaid program, it will definitely impact the care and the frequency of the care that they are able to receive. And we know that that's a big contributing factor to all of the underlying causes of infant mortality.
Amy Zagman is Executive Director of the Michigan Council for Maternal and Child Health. Thank you for talking with us today, Amy.
Thank you.
One of the biggest obstacles for Michigan's low-income and poor families, childcare and preschool. It's hard to get yourself to a job or go to classes when you have a 2-year-old on your hip. Coming up next, we'll see how one family met that challenge. This is a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to this State of Opportunity special. I'm Cynthia Canty. Among the hundreds of stories produced by the State of Opportunity team was the story of a Hillsdale family, Amanda and Mike Hood, and their 2 young daughters. Their story put a spotlight on the challenges low-income families face in finding affordable child care and preschool. At the time of this 2013 report from Jennifer Guerra, the Hoods' oldest daughter, Emma, was 5, and little Gracie, 2.
Emma attends Head Start right now and is headed to kindergarten in the fall. 2-year-old Gracie qualifies for the free toddler program called Early Head Start. But there's a wait list.
I was not told how many kids were in the class. I didn't realize there's only like 8 that they accept. And so when they told me about it, they're like, well, she goes from 8 to 4 and, you know, everything's great. We'll do this and we'll do that, you know, and we'll call you.
But no call came. And after several months, Hood called up the agency herself and found out that Gracie did not get in. Hood was devastated. She cried when she heard the news. See, Hood had big plans for herself once her daughters were in school full time. She'd go back to college during the day, get a job, and bring in some much-needed money for her family. None of that is easy to do with a 2-year-old at your hip.
If Gracie would be able to go to Head Start, then I could have a lot of schooling done already, and I could be done sooner. So as soon as Emma hits kindergarten, she's there all day, I can start working, and then I can pay for Gracie to go to preschool. That's the problem, is we don't have the funds to get Gracie to go anywhere. And if we had them, then we could move on. It just annoys me that we want to do something with our lives and we want to better ourselves and we want to get ahead, but we don't have a way to.
That was in 2013. So let's see what the past 4 years have brought for the Hood family. Amanda Hood is here with us now. Amanda, welcome.
Thank you.
So just so we're all very clear about what was happening for you 4 years ago, your older daughter, Emma, required a lot of medical attention for a rare disease she was born with, and she qualified for preschool under Head Start. But then little Gracie didn't get in, and you couldn't get out to take the job and take classes. How did you really feel with all of that?
I was devastated. I wanted to do something with my life. I didn't want to just sit here and not be able to help my husband, you know, with the bills or anything like that. Or I wanted to be able to have an education, even though my daughter needed a lot of care.
So what happened for your family after Jan Guerra's story aired?
Well, they had called me a few weeks later and said that a gentleman had heard our story on Michigan radio and wanted to offer to pay for Gracie to go to daycare until she got into kindergarten so I could continue and get into my schooling more.
Wow, what was that moment like?
It was a life changer. I would like to, you know, be able to catch up with him again and let him know, you know, that he changed our lives by just that little bit to get us where we needed to go. And we are so appreciative. I don't think that we would probably be sitting here right now, and I wouldn't be where I'm at today if that wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, what did that mean for you? What were you able to do?
Well, I was able to finish school. Actually, not finish school, but I was able to get into college, and I was able to take classes. Gracie was able to go to preschool through them times. I was able to take Emma to the doctors without having to take Gracie with me. Then by the time Gracie had gotten into kindergarten, I got to start taking school more seriously and take more classes. And actually, I just graduated last May.
Really? In what? What did you graduate in and what are you doing?
Well, I got my associate's in applied science, and I also am a medical assistant. I also have my EKG certification. I'm certified in other areas in medical assisting. And I just opened my own business in October.
What's your business?
My business is called it's Extraordinary Solutions, and it is community living services. And we help people that need adjusting after coming home from the hospital, or if they need help with scheduling rehab or doctor's appointments. We do indoor-outdoor activities. We do seasonal yard work and house chores. We help them with grocery shopping, meal prep, a little handyman jobs. We're a companion. Just basically anything they need help with, we're there.
To stop and think that had you not had Gracie in preschool, you'd be so much further behind.
We would. And I don't know if I would have picked up and decided to finish school.
What did that time in preschool mean for Gracie once she got to kindergarten?
Well, Gracie got to learn social skills. And they got to play outside and do little projects. And I think it incorporated her in sharing and being a part of something instead of me not being able to really take the time to help her learn letters and do a bunch of stuff that, you know, parents usually do with their kids when they're stay-at-home moms. But it really made a difference in how she responded to others.
And how are they doing in school now? What grades are they in?
Gracie is in first grade, and she is going to be 7 in August. And Emma is 9, and she is in third grade. And Emma just recently actually had a diaphragm pacer surgery and is doing well. And then Gracie is, she's such a smart little girl. She is doing her math facts, and she is a very sharing and loving sister. She tries to help Emma with everything. Emma is also bright and moving forward.
Amanda, what do you think our state lawmakers need to know and understand about the daily realities of life for parents with young kids and not a lot of financial resources?
You get very frustrated, and you try to do the best you can. And I think that these children need, you know, with what you get, even meals. Let's say, you know, even going to Head Start, you know, these children get breakfast and lunch, which some parents that don't have the money to be able to go to work, to stay at home, they can't afford to feed their kids a lot of healthy meals. Or, you know, the education on healthy meals, that's another thing. If you don't have the funds to send your kid to school, then, you know, you also don't have the funds to buy what you need for, you know, nutrition and knowing the right health, you know, foods and, you know, the right diet for your children.
What do the next 5 years look like for your family?
Oh, well, I hope I grow with my business. I just want people to know that I want to pay it forward, and that my daughters are both actually going to camp this year. Emma's going to event camp. Gracie's going to Camp Kimball, and they both get to have swimming lessons. So it's something that we could never do before, and I'm hoping over the next 5 years we can take a vacation with our kids that doesn't have to do with going to a conference for Emma syndrome. So to save up and be able to just take our kids on a vacation without having to do anything with medical, that would be awesome to see in the next 5 years, along with seeing more pre-K, you know, programs go up, and I don't know, just staying healthy and trying to help people.
Amanda Hood, we want to thank you so much for sharing your family's story with us, not only in 2013, but again with us today. Thank you so much, and best of luck with for the girls and for your husband and for your new business. We really want to thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Let's get the latest take on access to childcare in preschool. Susan Broman is with the Michigan Department of Education, where she is the Deputy Superintendent of the P-20 System and Student Transition. Susan, so glad to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Explain your job title to us. Exactly what do you do?
The P-20 is really thinking about early childhood, career, and tech education, as well as special education.
So quite a broad portfolio. So I'm so glad we could get you to kind of get your thoughts on the situation, for example, that we heard from Amanda Hood describing her family's dilemma in 2013. So they didn't have the money to pay for their littlest, for their two-year-old to go to preschool. But if she could have gotten into early Head Start, mom could have gone to work and brought in enough money to start to pay for it. So it was like such a catch-22. Is that a common story in our state?
It is still somewhat of a common story, but things have gotten remarkably better on that score. And you think about in April of 2011, Governor Snyder did an education reform speech, and that's where he announced that he was forming the Office of Great Start, issued an executive order in June of 2011. 2012, the legislature requires the Office of Great Start to develop a plan. What are you going to do in this new Office of Great Start? And that's where we really surveyed well over 1,700 Michiganders about what was working well in early childhood, what wasn't working, and what they wanted to see different. I say that's our guidebook, and I'm sticking to it, mm-hmm. and I've been working it since then.
Well, since that report, we know Governor Snyder and the legislature have added a total of $130 million expanding the Great Start Readiness Program. So what has that meant for families and for kids?
Well, what that means in simple terms is that we went from serving 20, and I'm doing round numbers, 28,000 kids to 38,000 kids, which is significant. When the bill was passed, the budget bill to do this, the legislature also did some changes with the Great Start Readiness Program and targeted it to people at 250% of the federal poverty level, with 10% being over that level. So again, there's an income eligibility requirement for the Great Start Readiness Program. But they also expanded it and required that all ISDs that receive the funding and then distribute it give the funding at least 30% of the slots to community-based organizations.
And ISDs, just for everybody who's not familiar with that term.
Intermediate school districts, and there are 54 in Michigan. And so what basically goes on is that they distribute the slots to community-based organizations as well as schools, and they're serving people who are at 250% of the federal poverty level or below, and they can serve 10% over that income level. What's also required from a quality perspective is that all of the schools as well as the community-based organizations have to be rated at least a 3-star in the Michigan quality rating system. So assuring quality and boosting availability and options for parents in the community. So it's not simply a school-based program,
but it's across diverse settings.
Susan, I know there have been many studies and recommendations, particularly focusing the 21st Century Education Commission report, recommending that all four-year-olds have access to preschool. So I know you're saying right now, with all the additional money, there's 38,000 little ones in. How are we doing on that goal of all four-year-olds with access?
Well, we're serving like 38,000 in the Great Start Readiness Program, serving another 15,000 in Head Start. And so if you think about it, there's around 110,000 four-year-olds in Michigan. So we're halfway to that mark.
So we got a long way to go.
Yes, we have a long way to go to have four-year-old preschool available for all children. Superintendent Whiston went one up on that, and not only is looking for preschool for all four-year-olds, but also preschool for all three-year-olds. His target is for all four-year-olds by 2020 and all three-year-olds by 2025.
And there we go, because you wonder, with the littlest ones, that was certainly the problem the Hood family faced, was finding a slot for their two-year-old. What will it take to get us to that point where we can have more of these littlest ones in and also the preschool for all four-year-olds?
Well, quite frankly, if I take a page out of what happened with the Great Start Readiness Program, there was an incredible amount of support from the business community and philanthropic community, as well as within government, as well as obviously the studies that proved the effectiveness of our preschool program. So it was really a broad coalition of people who were advocating for the expansion of preschool. So I would suspect that's the same thing that's going to need to happen this time, especially expanding into the three-year-olds.
Do you think that the lawmakers and the policymakers who set the budgets, who write the policies, truly understand the struggles low-income families face in Michigan?
Not really, because I think it's really difficult to figure out all of the pieces of the puzzle that low-income families are trying to put together to keep their families safe and comfortable. And, you know, one piece falls out and another piece is in trouble. So one of the things that I'm proud of that has happened with childcare in Michigan, and this is just one example of how this works, when people were deemed eligible for childcare, and by the way, Michigan's eligibility for childcare is probably one of the strictest in the country, what happened is when they got to a certain financial level, they were off childcare. So they couldn't really advance. During the last 2 years, we've been able to change the policy that once a person is on child care, that they continue to stay on child care subsidy until they get to 250% of the federal poverty level, which allows a person to progress and not lose their child care subsidy.
Doesn't help if you take a step forward and then get pushed two steps back.
Right, and that's what was happening. And so people were making decisions about jobs and all that because they saw, okay, I'm going to have now this child care expense that's not that my job or my increase in pay is not going to even out. And I, as I say to people all the time, you just have to do the math and figure out how difficult it is and how people are making decisions about these things.
Susan, how much of all of this depends on federal dollars?
Well, the child care subsidy program in Michigan, which is the child care development program, which funds child care subsidy across the state of Michigan, that is primarily federally funded. However, the state must also match a certain portion of the funds.
Well, the reason I'm asking is, as we know, the proposed budget from President Trump is hard on the social service kind of programs. I mean, how might it hit Michigan's children and families if the administration cuts or eliminates this funding?
Well, it'd be a significant blow. If you think about it, and probably this is a good time to be talking about it, when Michigan is at this level of employment, people are scrambling to find workers to fill jobs. And a fair number of people, when they say, why are they not working, a barrier is, in fact, childcare and reliable childcare.
That proposal, if in fact it goes through, will be a significant blow to Michigan, as well as to obviously families, but is also going to continue to erode our talent pool and the availability of people to enter the job market, because that's one of the barriers that's mentioned frequently is, number one, finding adequate childcare, and number two, the cost of childcare. And again, I say, do the math. If you're paying $10,000 per child in childcare, what is the salary that you would have to make to realize that?
How satisfied are you, Susan, personally, as you look at the availability and access to childcare and preschool for these low-income families in our state?
Well, we're obviously, I have a pretty high bar, and we're not there. But I would have to say that we are moving in the right direction. Governor Snyder's budget proposal for this year includes an increase in child care reimbursement rates for the child care subsidy program across the board. That's the first time we've had an across-the-board increase even talked about since 2008. That's significant in movement in the right direction.
Susan Broman is with the Michigan Department of Education, where she's Deputy Superintendent of the P-20 System and Student Transition. Susan, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Coming up next, we will meet a determined young woman who is beating the odds and earning a dual college degree. This is a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. The State of Opportunity team explored foster care in Michigan, particularly what happens once kids age out of foster care. In most states, you age out when you're 18, totally on your own. Now, Michigan is one of the few states giving young people the option to stay in foster care until they're 21. That can be helpful. One of the young people we met during State of Opportunity was Jasmine Ukta of Detroit. Jasmine aged out of Michigan's foster care system before the state raised its age limit. Jasmine was only 19 when she landed in the real world and had absolutely no safety net. Let's listen to a bit of reporter Jennifer Guerra's conversation from 2015 with Jasmine Ukta about her rough start.
It was pretty scary, to be honest. Every 18 and 19-year-old thinks they're ready. Everybody does. But you're not. No, you're not. You're not ready for shut-off notices. You're not ready for eviction notices. You're not ready for car repossessions.
Let me ask you a couple. Let's do a little checklist here. So when you were, when you aged out at 19, did you have a job?
When I first aged out, no.
Did you have a checking account?
No.
So I'm guessing you didn't have a savings account either?
No.
Did you have a car?
No. I didn't even know how to properly fill my refrigerator, honestly.
Like, what did you think went in your refrigerator?
I bought a bunch of snacks and junk that I never could really have as a child. Like, I bought everything that was horrible for me, so.
You didn't have your mom saying, more broccoli, put more broccoli in there, and put apples and milk and orange juice.
No, I didn't. I had, like, 10 boxes of cereal and 1 gallon of milk. And some Hot Pockets.
Jasmine Ukta can laugh about it now. But back then, she says she was really upset about how the whole thing went down when she aged out. The state had set her up with some transitional housing, but it fell through after a few months. She had nowhere to go. So she went to the only place she knew, her mom's house, a place Child Protective Services had removed her from twice.
The system does set you up, not for failure, but it sets you up to be a statistic, either to be in jail or to do some type of criminal activity or to go back to where you came from. So I feel like the system set me up to go back to my biological mother, the person that the state felt like you never should have been with in the first place.
Ukta was placed in foster care when she was 7 years old. She went back to live with her mom when she was 12, but wound up back in foster care by the time she was 16 and stayed there until she aged out. During that time, she says she went to 15 different schools and lived in 24 different foster homes. The older she got, the more times she had to move.
A lot of people did not want to deal with teenagers. So I was put in something called temporary placements. So I would be put into a temporary placement just about every week of my life because these parents didn't want a teenager. They preferred children.
You mean, so you would stay there, and then if they got, if they said, oh, we have a two-year-old who needs a place, they would kind of get you out of there and take the two-year-old.
Exactly. It made me feel like no one actually wanted me, to be honest.
That was in 2015. So let us see what Jasmine Ukta has been doing since that report aired nearly 2.5 years ago. Jasmine, welcome.
Hello. Hi, everyone. How are you?
Now, Jasmine, just a bit of context. How old are you now?
I'm 26 years old. I'll be 27 August 10th.
Okay. So not quite 10 years, but you've had quite a few years since you aged out of the foster system. And I think about it. You had to weather so much instability while you were in the system. As we heard, 15 different schools, 24 different foster homes. How'd you deal with all of that when you were so young?
I dealt with it in a way where, and I don't mean to get spiritual, but I believe in God, and I felt like God sent certain people in my life to keep me afloat and to keep me motivated and to keep me inspired and to tell me, despite the situation, that I can overcome. And I really appreciate those individuals being in my life and helping me see the silver lining out of different situations that I was faced.
And someone who made a really big difference in your life after foster care was a special mentor. Tell us about her and how she helped you.
Yes, her name is Saba Gabari, and she works with Park West Foundation. She created this program called Blue Babies, which was a program where foster youth, younger foster youth, such as myself and others, we would come together as a community, as like a big brother, big sister type of program, and we would help volunteer, provide rides for each other to and for the work and classes. We would volunteer at churches or whatever program that needed some type of assistance or needed some type of help. Like, we were a community and also a family. And Ms. Saba Gabari, she showed me that humans really do have a heart, despite how sometimes we make mistakes and certain situations have us react a certain way. But if you see the silver lining or you think outside of the box, that you can see the beautiful thing in every situation. And I thank God for her and also my pastor. Her name is Virginia Williams. Because of these two young ladies, I believe that's what saved my life and why I'm so humble and I'm such a peaceful person now.
When you aged out of foster care, it was about the time you started as a freshman at Wayne State University. Tell us what that was like, transitioning from the foster care system to being a full-time college student.
It was very rough at first. My first semester, I didn't do so well because it was my first time on my own and juggling with different things in life and trying to deal with school and keep up with the grades and maintain a dorm without any realistic support besides these young ladies that were in my life. It was very difficult for me, and I felt a little bit envious of other college students who had, you know, more family support, more income to provide for themselves. But through the grace of God, I made it through.
You did leave Wayne State after a couple semesters. What'd you do then?
After then, I started to work several jobs. I had got my first apartment right by, I was very proud to have this, by Belle Isle River. And I worked at the Eastern Market for a few years, and then until I got a little bit more stable. And then I returned to Oakland Community College, where I graduated 2015.
And you got some money, didn't you, through a state program called the Fostering Futures Scholarship. That must have made such a difference as you went forward.
Yes, 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 ma'am. That helped a lot with my tuition, and I didn't have to take out as many. Because when I first started at Wayne State University, I didn't know anything about filling out financial aid. I didn't know anything about scholarships. I didn't know what grants were provided for foster youth. And because of Saba Gabari, my mentor, she helped me find resources and different programs and got introduced to different people to network. And they were like, oh, we have this great foster care program, which was Fostering Futures. I wrote a letter. Technically, to be honest, I was not qualified for the program due to the fact I had messed up my first semester. However, after writing a letter and getting several supports, I received a scholarship, and I was chosen to speak in front of Governor Snyder.
So you learned to push back, didn't you? You didn't just take what happened and say, okay, that's it. You pushed back.
I pushed back very hard, and it was very successful. I got the scholarship for several semesters. And as I stated, this is what helped me to graduate from Oakland Community College with little to not much debt and loans, which I'm very thankful for because many people can't say that.
And now you're back at Wayne State. What are you studying?
Right now I'm studying business, and I'm also going for social work. This past December, I'm part of a program at Wayne State University called TIP. It's Transitioning to Independence. And this is also a program for foster youth who are in the state of Michigan who need mental, physical, food support. They help out with book scholarships. They help out with tuition and fees. They connected me with a program that sent me to Washington, D.C., which allowed me to get an internship.
I'm hearing that there's help out there that you've been able to take advantage of to get help you get through school, which is really beating the odds because we know that once kids age out of foster care, they're so much less likely to graduate college. There was one study done by the University of Chicago. It found only 2.5% of former foster kids in the Midwest had graduated from college by age 26. But there you are. You're beating the odds, and you're going to be graduating with this dual degree.
Yes.
Is there anything that you would want to see changed in Michigan's foster care system? Something that could make it easier for those who are following you through the system?
Yes. And this is, I went to D.C. to speak on a bill specifically for this, is not to sound biased or anything, but foster youth have an extremely hard time. And this is why the statistics are very low in graduating, because it takes more than just to have the finances to go to college. You also have to have that mental support. You have to have that physical support. You have to have counseling. You have to have someone to help you motivate. And so I feel like what would help more is if different universities and colleges have programs that are stimulated to foster youth that can help support them to aid, because we don't have the family to be there for us. We don't have the family to say, I'll buy you a pen or pencil or notebook, or I'll help, here's $50 towards a $200 book, or, you know, we don't have that extra family to even cook us a meal after class. So I feel like programs like TIP, if it can be expanded across different universities, different states, that would really help out those statistics to help people. Because I know for myself, if I didn't have these programs or these people to help back me up, there's no way possible I would be where I am right now. No way possible. So if we can increase programs to help out foster youth, and also to higher the age cap that's on there, because I found out there's a lot of programs and scholarships that end at 22 and 23 years old, when it's like we're just now getting on our feet and just now getting our mentality right to be able to handle this type of lifestyle once we get to that age. So if we can increase the age cap, and if we can increase the scholarship and programs throughout universities, that will really help out America in general.
Jasmine, I know for so much of your childhood, your mother was not able to be there for you because of her own struggles. But my understanding is the two of you were able to rebuild your relationship over the past couple of years before she passed away last fall.
Yes. In the past 2 years, me and my mother, we have become very, very, very close. Like, we were able to bridge gaps and different things that happened throughout my youth. We were finally able to talk about and to heal old wounds, which I think also helped aid to such, to me being such a peaceful person, is that a lot of hurt that I had before I could let go. And so, unfortunately, when she passed in October, there was no animosity, there was no pain, there was no frustration, no anything. It was that, you know, it was painful that it was my mother, and I loved her, and I finally got so close to her, but it wasn't like, oh, I'm mad at this person type thing, if you understand.
I do. I do. It's like things were at peace, and that's what you hope for. Jasmine, when you look at where you are in your life right now and what you've gone through so many years in the foster care system, what are you most proud of?
That I'm still alive, honestly. And
wow.
I haven't lost my mind. I'm sane. I'm not a bitter person. I'm not angry. I'm able to enjoy life in general, and that's the best gift that anybody could ever have, is just to enjoy life.
Jasmine Ukda, we want to thank you for sharing your story with us, for being a part of State of Opportunity, and we wish you the very, very best of luck as you work on those 2 degrees at Wayne State University.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate you all for having me again.
When State of Opportunity began in 2012, its special introduction quickly became a listener and a staff favorite.
State of Opportunity.
State of Opportunity.
I want to be a firefighter.
A ballerina.
I want to be a Batman.
That was 5 years ago. As we wrap up our final State of Opportunity special, let's listen to the 2017 version as today's children share their dreams with us.
So far, I've decided to be a structural engineer or an electrician, but I also have an interest in becoming a biologist.
A scientist. A violin player.
A lot of things. I love art and performance, so either an actress or an artist, so I'd like to try both out.
I want to be a lawyer.
Do you know what kind of lawyer?
Not right now.
Scientist.
Engineer.
I haven't really thought about that yet.
You're pretty young.
Yeah.
Any ideas?
No, not really. Thought about being a teacher until I found out what they got paid.
When I grow up, I either want to be an architecture, in the architecture business, or be a zoologist. Yeah.
Meaning, like, what does that mean?
It means I would be able to be sort of like a vet, but with being able to handle more exotic animals.
Like, what's the most exotic animal you'd want to handle?
Probably a tiger.
I want to be either a computer engineer or a computer programmer or a photographer.
Probably something to do with art and technology, because I'm always on my tablet. So something along those lines. Or I might do graphic designing or something like that.
Well, I never thought about that, really, but I still have to think about it. And I was thinking maybe a wrestler or a mixed martial artist.
When I grow up, I want to be either a fashion designer or a dancer.
You have something that has to do with baking, technology, or clothes.
And I want to be a police officer when I grow up. Save people.
And a reminder, our State of Opportunity team of Sarah Alvarez, Dustin Dwyer, Jennifer Guerra, Paulette Parker, and April Van Buren have turned out dozens and dozens of stories over this five-year project. You can listen to these stories very easily. Just go to michiganradio.org, look under Programs and Specials, and scroll down. You'll find the State of Opportunity link. Again, start by going to michiganradio.org. The executive producer is Joe Lindstraw. Contributors are Melissa Benmark, Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Josh Hakala, Bryce Huffman, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, and Nicholas Wallace. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.